and welcome to another edition of Admit One with me, Antonia O'Brien, where each week I challenge a special guest with the task of picking their top three favourite films.
I mean, whatever you say about him, he wrote some fantastic roles for women.
Joining me on this episode is film watcher, football lover, entertainment director of Heat magazine, Mr. Boyd Hilton.
And of course, it's got the greatest ending, the most stressful and evil ending of any film ever.
Boyd, welcome. I've never seen you in your civvies, you know, because time I've seen you, we've been working together doing Oscars coverage, and we're always dressed in our finery.
Yeah.
That's actually
the only time I'm ever dressed in a suit, so, you know, that's weird, yeah. Once a year.
I know. Well, I always know you to be in your Sunday best. So, Boyd, tell me, how did you get into your line of work?
My first ever job was working for a company that did TV listings for newspapers and magazines. And I rose up, you know, so it's like a central company that did them all. And
which I'm going to guess is just listing what's on TV?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But, you know, it has to be, people have to know what they're talking about. You know, you get to write about TV and films in that small little way. And then I did that for years and, like, became, like, the editor of that company, you know. And then I worked for Press Association writing about the same kind of thing. And then when Heat launched, which is 18 years ago, believe it or not, yes. I know your face, yeah.
I remember it launching, but I don't feel old enough.
No,
but obviously,
same. Well, I've been working there for 18
obviously
years.
Obviously, I am old enough.
The company that started Heat, which was then called EMAP, had never done a weekly magazine that dealt with television particularly. So they knew I knew about that. So they hired me to kind of sort that out for them. And I've just been there ever since, writing about TV and film. And then now I'm in charge of the entertainment coverage, yeah.
Wow, 18 years.
18 years.
Your film memories, do you have a first film memory or the first time you went to the cinema that, you know, you could...
Yeah, it's kind of like a collective thing because my parents took me and my brother to see James Bond films from a very early age when I was growing up. So it wasn't a case of like, I mean, we would see them as soon as they came out as well, but they would show them and double bills in cinemas in the West End. So, yeah.
It's
weird.
I love a back-to-back cinema
trip. Yeah, so this is kind of... Because in the days before, you know, VHS even, and in those days you couldn't just... You couldn't actually hire a VHS of a film, let alone watch one on Netflix or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It was a completely different world. So, yeah, you could go to cinema, the Dominion, I remember, in Tottenham Court Road, would show James Bond films back to back. That's pretty much like my first memory of going to the cinema. And then both my parents were really into it and they would take us to films a lot. So, from about mid-70s onwards, I was going to cinema to see films when I was like 8, 9, 10. And I very clearly remember seeing... Even like Woody Allen films, one of which we'll get to later, sorry, I'm giving it away. But I remember being taken to the cinema to see, you know, Sleeper, which was in 1975, I think, and I was like about 8. I loved it. So, yeah, there you go.
I always love talking to people about their first cinema experiences on Admit One because, you know, life before Netflix, before downloading, before Instagram. Like you said, back-to-back Bond films. Why don't they do that anymore? That would be an awesome way to spend a hungover Sunday.
Yeah, I think probably the Prince Charles cinema, you know, they probably do. They're probably the only ones who do it anymore, yeah.
Talking about Oscars, the campaigns are in full swing.
Yes.
When we have done the Oscar coverage together, we'd always do a sweepstake, and Boyd, you always bloody won.
Well, I think most of the time, you're right.
Disclaimer, most of the time. But enough to be like, how does he know this?
Well, I do remember Alex Zane hosts it every year, and he won it the year before last, I seem to remember, because we do every single category. So let's be honest, you know, we haven't all seen the best animated short. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen a lot of them. But there's a certain amount of guesswork, educated guesswork, that goes on with those really obscure categories. But in terms of the main categories, I do follow the... It's a whole process, isn't it? It kind of starts late in the year before with, festivals, Toronto Festival, and then suddenly, you know, all the big films get released now pretty much from November in America through to January, you know, to qualify. And you've got like suddenly like 20 films that are all prestigious, good films up for the Oscars. So you just kind of have to follow how they're doing and how the campaigns are going. And then you end up with the position we're in now where I think it's fairly clear what's going to win.
I mean, I'd love to know what are your predictions
for
the big ones.
Yes.
We'll leave out the animated
Best
short.
Documentary short, yeah.
We'll leave that out today.
La La Land versus Moonlight, I think, is the main battle. So La La Land's obviously got 14 nominations, which is the joint highest ever in the history of the Oscars, which is incredible. And I think it will win a lot. I mean, you know, it's going to win all the song and a lot of the technical ones, you know. But I wonder whether La La Land, there's a slight backlash about it, that it's all about, you know, Hollywood films about Hollywood win every year, you know, and Hollywood loves films about, you know, actors, would-be actors, and this, which is what it's about. It's great. I loved it, you know, really enjoyed it. But is Moonlight, will it be considered a more of an artistic triumph than La La Land? Might they be thinking slightly guiltily, you know, oh, everyone's just living in this fantasy world for La La Land. Maybe we should keep it real and go from it. So I think La La Land's the favourite, to cut this very long-winded answer short, but I do think Moonlight's a big threat.
I mean, the Oscars are always very political between the campaigns that are run between the huge production companies, but also with last year's hashtag, you know, Oscars white
Oscars
out,
so white,
Oscars
yeah.
so white. Yeah. This year, maybe it would be slightly self-indulgent, navel-gazing, and a bit too...
I agree,
I don't know. I feel like I am obsessed with La La Land.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But a lot of people I talk to, I think there's been so much hype.
Yeah.
I think people are a bit La La Landed out.
Absolutely.
And I think the powerful, more important sway might be supporting a smaller film.
Yeah, I agree, tackle
LGBT and the racial divide in Hollywood. So you think it's just between those two for Best Picture?
Oh, yeah, I really do,
Do
I think it's pretty clear, I mean, you know, and in previous years, you know, the Oscars is the one ceremony. It's partly because of the way the voting works with Best Picture. This is Best Picture I'm talking about mainly. I still think La La Land will win a lot of, you know, other awards. But all the Oscar voters are sitting there with their screeners of these films, and they're all going to watch them. They're very diligent. And I wonder whether they actually sit there and watch Moonlight, and they go, oh, you know, actually, they might not have seen E! Up until this process. This is a pretty incredible film.
Yeah.
I wonder if actually it might hit home with all the reasons you suggested, Oscar so white and all that, and then make them feel better about themselves to vote for Moonlight.
So, I mean, this is a tricky question for someone who is such a film lover. We will be going on to your three favourite films.
Mm.
Do you have a favourite actor or actress?
I probably don't really. I mean, there's loads that I love.
Mm.
Whose films do I get most excited about? I mean, we are talking about him, so again, it's a spoiler, but I have seen every single Woody Allen film ever made. I mean, you know, I'm still loyal to him through thick and thin. So, I mean, you know, and obviously occasionally every now and then he still does act. And
you can't see this, but Boyd has got a serious,
very intense,
intense
thought
thinking
process
phase.
Going on. Yeah. But people like Al Pacino still does it for me, even though he's done some terrible films, you know, absolutely appalling films he's done in recent times. But I will dutifully go and see every single film he's ever been in. So, you know, I'm going to have to be honest about that. And, I mean, there's people like Meryl Streep, again, you know, who's such an obvious choice. But I can't think of a film of hers that I haven't seen. And I do get excited about seeing what she's going to do every time she does something. Yeah.
Mine's also kind of obvious when you say, you know, like with Meryl, from Titanic to Before the Flood, DiCaprio. His choices are so classy.
Yeah, do you know
and
what?
He has never done a duff in my... eyes.
Well, now
he's never done a dodgy kind
of crap
rom-coms.
Yeah, no, you're right.
You know, he's not done any
you're
that you're
right.
like, what the hell were you thinking?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like Blood Diamond.
Right. Yeah,
like,
that's what I was thinking of. That was okay.
So,
yeah.
You know, his Saffir accent's maybe not the best, but, you know, if that's the worst we can hang him out to dry for, then...
This is going to sound really harsh about Leo, but I would never pick Leo as an actor that I actually go to see the film because of him. It's weird, isn't it, that he's absolutely great in everything.
Yes.
But I wouldn't see a film because of him. So, I mean, I've just realised Julianne Moore would be my actress. So I would see a film just because of her, definitely. So even though she's done a few quite earnest, slightly dull films every now and then.
Alice,
but
I wept for a day.
Fair enough.
It was exhausting.
Yeah, I would see everything that she's in because it's worth it for her. But I don't have that feeling about Leo at all.
She is a class act.
She's fantastic, yeah.
Boyd and I, we would love to know who you think is going to win at the Oscars. Do you agree? Disagree? We'd love to hear from you. So do get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Antonia O'Brien. That's me. And he's at Boyd Hilton. And the hashtag is AdmitOne. Whilst you're there, we'd love you to give us a review on iTunes and tell your friends. It's actually quite hard to decide on your three favourite films. So give it a go. Share the love. We'd love that. So, Boyd, what is the first film? What are we going to start with?
Why don't we go chronologically? Well, we've mentioned him. So, Woody Allen, yeah.
Okay, let's go with Woody.
Let's get him out of the way.
So, big Woody Allen fan.
Yeah, huge. Yeah, and, you know, I'm a Jewish, middle-class, North London boy. My parents were into him when I was growing up. They're kind of into, you know, Jewish comedians generally and that kind of comedy. And he was the standard bearer of a certain kind of kind of self-deprecating, you know, schlubby character, of course, that he created. And so I was totally aware of him from a very early age, literally like 7, 8, you know, 9. And I remember I was actually taken to see Manhattan when it came out in 1980. I was 13. I was absolutely blown away by it. Annie Hall had a slightly more depth to it, to use that, I don't know, you know, whether that matters or not, but, you know, it felt more about stuff rather than just being one joke after another. And then came Manhattan a couple of years after that, which is similarly kind of slightly dramatic, but really, really funny and beautiful to look at. It's the most beautiful film ever made. It opens with this incredible montage sequence of him kind of writing a book about himself in New York and talking about why he loves New York, with just a series of widescreen shots of Manhattan by Gordon Willis, who was the director of photography for The Godfather and stuff like that, very famous for being like the master of shadows and light. And George Gershwin music in the background.
It's beautiful. It's like a love letter. You know?
Yeah, it's a love letter. Exactly.
To his city,
exactly.
To New York.
I think it's one of the greatest openings of a film ever. From then on, it's really funny. The first scene is hysterically funny when he's sitting in this bar restaurant, smoking, he's drunk, talking about his new young girlfriend who's like 17. And the whole thing is, it's just that rare coming together of, it's relentlessly funny, the one-liners are brilliant, it's kind of about something, you know, it's about this guy, you know, dubious morality of his own character, really, to some extent, and the nature of love and all of that, as all his films are, I guess. It's stunningly beautiful to look at. Has to be seen on the big screen, this widescreen, black and white photography of New York. The Gershwin music, everything about it is unbelievably great.
Because I was going to say, on knowing we were talking about this and watching Manhattan again and reading up about it, the film itself was shot in Technicolor.
Yeah.
And then, you know, made black and white. Mm. Why do you think Woody Allen chose to do that?
I think it was a technical thing, wasn't it, from the director of photography.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think he thought that was the best way to do it. Yeah, I mean, well, I think Woody always wanted to be in black and white. I think he knew that, I'm pretty sure. And then from the technical point of view, it was best to do it that way. And then you could be in charge of, you could make sure the way it looked in terms of the use of light in it, which is incredible. Just, it made sense to film it in that process, so yeah.
And I mean, the people he has in it, a young Meryl Streep.
Yes.
A young, very foxy Diane Keaton.
Yeah.
Seeing them as young, beautiful women, and
yeah, it's so interesting,
it's so brilliant to see them in their kind of earlier career.
And Mariel Hemingway, his young girlfriend in it. Also,
what's she been in?
Well, not very much. That's interesting, yeah. I mean, this was a big kind of break for her. She was very young at that time. She did a few films after that, but I think she kind of went on to do other stuff as well.
I mean, seeing Woody Allen, you know, playing Isaac, a man in his 40s, going out the 17-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, the story of Woody Allen and his life and his personal choices in real life, you kind of watch it thinking, this is so odd that he's done this.
Yeah,
it's strange thing, and one that... I'm really, really bold, actually. If that was done today, I think people would, again, think it was quite an odd choice.
Yeah, you probably couldn't
to have such a young on-screen girlfriend and bed scenes.
Absolutely.
And you kind of think, really?
Yeah, you probably couldn't get away with it today. But I completely separate the artist and whatever they've been held up to doing or not doing.
Of course.
Morally.
I think with Woody Allen,
with Woody,
you have to.
Yeah.
You really have to.
So, but in terms of that costume, and I just want to say, Diane Keaton, I mean, yeah, she is... I love Woody, and you know, this is, he's at his peak kind of funniness on screen, but she is hilarious. And she of course, he was seeing her at this time, you know, and she was in all his films at this time. She's in Love and Death and Sleeper and Annie Hall and this. But she's one of the funniest performers, one of the funniest actors. In a lot of other films, she's like the kind of slightly innocent, naive one that he's educating. That's what it's like in Annie Hall. But in this, it's the other way around. She's the really smart, hyper-intellectual one. And he's the kind of like, you know, not
threatened.
Quite... Threatened by her. And it's so interesting that he wrote that role. I mean, whatever you say about him, he wrote some fantastic roles for women. Mm. And, you know, when then Mia Farrow, of course, became his partner and she was in all his films... I mean, incredible stuff. All the roles that she did with him are fantastic.
Boyd, I could sit here and talk to you solely about Woody Allen for maybe in the next hour and a half. What is your second film choice?
Second film choice is, in complete contrast, Seven. I love David Fincher, the director. I think he's absolute. I think he's the director. You talk about, you know, do you go and see films for actors? I'm so excited every time I knew David Fincher.
Is this your favourite David Fincher?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And I think he's done some fantastic films. Fight Club, I think, still holds up as a phenomenal film. I loved Gone Girl. I interviewed him at BAFTA. You see, this is my big name drop. I interviewed him at BAFTA, did a Life in Pictures.
We love a good name drop in here.
And he was so fascinating.
I mean, that must be a, something of a career highlight.
It was a career highlight.
What did you say? What was the opening question?
I think my opening question was about it was about Gonga, because Gonga was about to come out here. And hardly anyone had seen it yet. And I was very excited because they let me see it. Because I was like, right, you can see it because you're about to interview him. So it was all about, oh, wow, you know, how pleased are you? Because, you know, he had to edit it just in time to get it ready for the Oscars, funny enough. It's all about, always about the Oscars. And he was like, yeah, I'm really pleased with it. So we just, it was talking about, you know, whether he was nervous about it. He was really excited. He said how excited he gets when a film finally is unleashed on
and
the world.
And he's happy with it. Well, I guess the process of it from start to finish must be just so all-consuming.
Of course, he famously literally does 70 or 80 takes. For scenes, you know, no exaggeration, and he admitted that. I asked him about that in the talk. He was like, "Yeah, gosh. I do. I apologize to every actor I've ever worked with."
You'd be like, "Oh, come on!"
Yeah, but Seven is a film, so this is, you know, the original serial killer thriller, and I think it's had a huge influence on culture and pop culture because every year now there's another serial killer film or TV, in loads of TV dramas that deal with this. And they've all got the kind of look of Seven, I feel. I think it established this kind of visual, murky, greeny, grey, browny...
Raining, miserable.
Raining, exactly. The visual of it is unbelievably influential. And you watch it now and you think, oh, yeah, it's, everything looks like that. Particularly every crime thriller looks like this. But that got established, that look, that film. And it's gotten this incredible story of a serial killer who... You kind of, they're investigating, you're trying to pick up the clues, but it's really not about, it's not really a whodunit because suddenly the serial killer reveals himself, spoiler alert, towards the end. So it's not really about the viewer working out who he is. It's all about why he's doing what he's doing and the perversity of his plan of kind of following the seven deadly sins. And then you've got Morgan Freeman, peak Freeman, you know. He's another actor who I absolutely love and adore. But this is his definitive, he's like exuding...
Peak Freeman, I like that.
Yeah, exuding dignity. That's the thing, you know. He is like the man who knows everything, who's teaching this annoying little tyke, played by Brad Pitt. You know,
and
how
they're a great on-screen pairing.
Gwyneth Paltrow is brilliant. And it's a very small role, obviously, as Brad Pitt's girlfriend in it. And this is a rare film, I think. For me, the films that I love most, and all three films on this list, but particularly Seven, goes with this, is every single scene is key. Every moment in Seven is doing something with the story or the characters. It's advancing the narrative and it's beautifully shot. Every moment looks incredible. And that for me is that's the test of a brilliant film, is everything in every shot, in every scene, is as great as it can possibly be.
So do you love a film that has that kind of pace? Because we were talking about Fences and how that's hard, hard work. Well, I found it, you know, tough by just before the 2 hour mark, something finally happens.
Yeah.
Do you like that fast pace that you're kind of involved from the opening credits?
I don't mind if the pace is gentler, and I quite like films that have a steady pace as well. Like Moonlight, we're talking about. That's not a film where a tremendous amount happens. But I would stay with Moonlight. You know, even though it's not a fast pace, every scene is absolutely key. And that's what I'm talking about, really. I can't stand any film or TV drama or anything where there's filler. And I think you can always tell when there's filler in a film, you know. And there's no filler. I mean, I don't think there's any filler in any of these films, but Seven is so... And again, to drop Fincher's name again, I asked him about that. I said, you know, it feels to me like your films generally, you're very, very ruthless when it comes to making sure that every single scene is important. He's like, absolutely. Seven, I think he cut half an hour, very close to it coming out. You know, half an hour. I mean, it seems incredible to think. But there was just stuff. And so he pares everything down. And that pared down to the bone storytelling, along with one of the most visually stunning films. Again, all of these films look fantastic, I think.
Peak Freeman, Peak Pitt,
yeah. Looks great, is great. Everyone in it is likeable, you know, all the protagonists, Paltrow, Pitt, Freeman, all very likeable. And of course it's got the greatest ending, the most stressful and evil ending of any film ever. And the writer, Andrew Walker, I think his name was, and Fincher insisted to the studio, if you get rid of this ending, we're walking away. And they kept it, and it's an incredibly bold, brave ending, the bravest ending in the history of Hollywood, I think. And, you know, to get a serial killer film that has this incredible ending, that's a rare thing as well.
I need to watch that again.
Yeah, sit through that ending again.
I think I need to sit through that again. And Boyd Hilton, your final choice.
Midnight Run. Now, Midnight Run is ostensibly a kind of buddy road movie crime caper, you know, but it's like the greatest road movie crime caper, again, I think, ever. Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. And remember, when Robert De Niro did this film, he was really known only for being this intense guy who did Martin Scorsese films. you know, was known for being incredibly heavyweight actor. And suddenly, thank God, he was given this script where he's funny
bit
and
of a
light,
lighter romp.
Massive, entire, very light. But, you know, it's from the Midnight Run, this example of a comedy that is so perfectly written. The script is so brilliant and it's directed with such a light touch. And the script is so great, the stuff that it gives De Niro to say and do. And then he's matched with Charles Grodin, who I absolutely adore. And at the time, again, Charles Grodin was not very famous. You know, he's done a lot of great films, but, you know, wasn't a box office draw. De Niro was. But they could have had, you know, Eddie Murphy, I think, they wanted originally the studio. But they stuck with Charles Grodin, who's hilarious in it. He's so funny.
What happens in the film?
It's about... So Charles Grodin is this white-collar criminal who was an accountant for the mob, and he blows the whistle on them. So he wants to expose his bosses that he's been working for, but the government won't go along with his plan. So then he goes on the run, and De Niro is a bounty hunter who's bringing him in from being on the run. So Charles Grodin is like doing stuff for good. De Niro is kind of doing something really just because for the money. And they're stuck together, they're literally handcuffed together for half the film. And De Niro is this very working class ex-cop. Charles Grodin is a posh, you know, it's kind of like class-based comedy. It's educated, not educated, and it's vulgar versus, you know, De Niro swearing all the time throughout and Charles Grodin doesn't approve of him. The pairing is one of the great pairings in film history.
Well, I feel like we've talked quite a lot about sort of on-screen pairings.
Yes.
Pitt and Freeman,
yeah.
Grodin and De Niro. I think one of mine, I don't know why this has just sprung to mind, but I would say John Candy, Steve Martin, Planes, Trains and Automobiles.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Right?
I think Planes, Trains and Automobiles has got a lot in common with Midnight Run because they're both essentially road movies. They are both two men bonding over something. And
in like an unlikely circumstance.
Yeah, and just that relationship between Steve Martin, it's similar. It's very similar. So, yeah, I think that's a good shout. Yeah,
well, hands up, I haven't seen Midnight Run, but if you are comparing it to Planes, Trains and Automobiles, I mean, I think John Candy is one of my favourites as well.
Oh, he was brilliant.
So, Boyd, before coming in to Admit One, you had to pick your three favourite films.
Yeah.
And we also do ask our guests a question they're not expecting, which is, if you had to choose an actor to play you in the story of your life,
oh,
alive or dead, male or female,
wow,
actor or
question.
Not, we can just choose. I mean, you could choose a football player.
That'd be weird.
Let's really
it?
Open it wide open,
if I
Boyd.
Chose a football player, that would be bizarre. Let me think. I'm going to have to wrap my brains again. I mean, the obvious answer would be Woody Allen, really, wouldn't it? You know, so I'm trying to think of something slightly less obvious because I've gone on about him so much. Actually, no, I'll tell you what, he's a more Larry David. He's like the modern version, you know, from Curb Your Enthusiasm. There you go.
Excellent.
You know, he's
shout.
The kind of like, he's the Woody Allen irritating Jewish white middle-aged guy of the noughties, isn't he? You know, so, and he's like what you want to say. He says, you know, like when you're in a cafe and you're given a terrible latte or something, he says what you want to say rather than the I'm obviously British polite guy who just go, oh yeah, that's great, thanks.
Thank you so, for yeah. my cold
yeah,
latte.
So
thank
Larry
you.
David, I'd like Larry David to play. I'd like to be Larry David, and if push comes to shove, yeah, he can play me.
Yes, Boyd Hilton, thank you so much.
Thank
I mean,
you.
The time is rolling and I could sit here and just chat films, Woody Allen and the Oscars with you for hours. But thank you so much for coming in to Admit One. Boyd Hilton, thanks.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. Next week on Admit One.
I take my hat off to actors. The ones I've met are some of the most intense people and so bright and so clever.
Singer-songwriter Tony Mortimer.
They don't just act, they don't just say lines and read scripts and put a bit of emotion in. They go in and they dissect the character.
Don't forget to subscribe to Admit One on iTunes for more movie memories from my stellar lineup of guests. Admit One with Antonia O'Brien is an Audioboom production.